Not everyone starts out wanting to produce television. Some are just still photographers who move on to video. But storytelling was always at the core of it all for Chris Gourley. Hello, I'm Paul Yeager, and this is the M2M Podcast, a production of Iowa Public Television. Gourley retired as a producer from Market to Market. His career took him all over the world and led to some great experiences. And some, he says, maybe he was a little too naive to fully understand what was happening around him.
Did you always want to be a television producer? Or when you were little Chris Gourley, what did you want to be?
A fireman. No, I don't know.
You don't want to...
I think that what got me interested in this sort of thing was back in high school, I took a photography class. And at that time, I thought, God, it'd be the best thing in the world to be like a photographer for National Geographic. Ended up going to Iowa State and enrolled in the journalism classes there and decided that wasn't really what I wanted to do. So they had a speech telecommunicative arts program and got into that. And TV seemed to be the right fit. And it was a good choice.
But you still take stills. And you still take video,
yep.
Right? When are those two separate for you? Or are they together?
I've been accused of being a still photographer that shoots video because I don't do a lot of zooms or pans or tilts. One of the first things I learned in speech telecommunicative arts was that every frame of every piece of footage that you shoot should be a still image. And if you're doing pans, that's not the necessarily, there's going to be a lot of dead space sometimes between them. So if you're going to do a pan, you're going to do a tilt, you're going to do a zoom, it's got to be a motivated movement. It can't be just putting something out there for the sake of movement. There's got to be a reason and rhyme for it. So a lot of times, even when I was shooting video, it was mostly just still images.
And I think that's part of the reason we like each other. I like your style because I'm that same way. Trained as a still photographer, I think a pan and a zoom is a bailout to me for not a well-composed shot.
And a pan or a zoom can cover a paragraph too if you wanted to. You know, if you're looking for something that needs to fill some audio that you don't necessarily have any video images for, you can do that. I wasn't very fond of ever shooting exteriors. I didn't think that a picture of a sign had anything to do with a good storytelling. And I think that was the primary thing, was that you got to be a good storyteller. And you can't... I also told people that I thought that television was like 80% audio and 20% video, which twisted people's heads around here quite often. You got to have great audio. You got to have a great story. And the video is important too, but a lot of times you can get bad with long, or you can get by with bad audio or bad video, but not with bad audio.
I contend that. I don't know if I saw you at the State Fair, but I don't know if I told you what I did at the State Fair. We did a bunch of Facebook Lives, and we knew the video quality wasn't going to be that good. But what I said is we have to have good audio. Because even on the internet today, you will watch something as long as it has good audio. Because if it's overmodulated and sounds, you'll click and go on to something else. That hasn't changed.
Yeah. Tyler posted some stuff. He does some great stuff on the internet, and he shares them. And I saw a story he did a while back, and I told him, I said, the thing that really wowed me the most was the way he did the audio. It was like it just flowed from one thing to the next. And to me, that was the most important. He had great video, too, and he had a great story, but the audio was flawless. I tell people it's like my job was to, I called it seamless editing, I guess, where you didn't want anything to trip anything up where it's taken away from the story. So if you're editing music and the beat isn't right, or you try to tighten it up and it's going thump, 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 you know, all of a sudden it's not right. And people go, what was that? Instead of listening to the story you're telling. So my goal, even with the video, was to make it as seamless as possible.
And you started as a videographer, right?
Here I did.
And when you were at WHO-TV.
WHO-TV started off doing studio productions. We were doing newscasts and things like that. They gave me some programs to do and made me in charge of I was like the first person in the production department that would go out and do commercial work with a remote video camera. And I was doing a story or doing a show called Talking to People with Ruth Ann Gaines-Rohn. And we'd go out and do that, and it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that a lot more than maybe the studio stuff, because when you're in the studio and you're doing a newscast, if something happens, it's done, it's gone, it's out there forever. Whereas if you're doing small format television where you're going out in the field and shooting stuff, you come back and you create something and you can make it so you're really happy with it, hopefully, when you mm-hmm. get all done.
Mm-hmm.
So they started a program called PM Magazine, and it was a syndicate.
I remember watching it, yeah.
Of
syndicated
program with stations all across the U.S. They would pool these stories that they'd do, and they'd put together a national reel, and you'd sort of supplement it with some local stuff as well. And really liked that a lot. So I got a job here. And at the time, I was actually a producer, director, editor, everything there. Moving here, they were looking for a videographer. So I actually was running sound for a year or two, just going out in the field and doing that. And then got promoted to being a videographer and eventually became a producer, director, writer, the whole ball of wax.
You worked on shows here. Living in Iowa was what you worked on probably the longest, right? And that was a Iowa-focused television show that was heavy on the storytelling. Yeah. And it was about stories and visuals. It might not have been the news of the week or month or year. What stories do you remember that you've done, that you did on Living in Iowa, that still today you go, gosh, that was fun?
Well, it's kind of funny because I go back and I look at them, and some of the stories I thought I'd nailed, I go back and it was like, maybe not so much. Some of the ones that I thought I failed miserably on, it's like, that one actually worked out pretty well. I'm surprised that I actually did that story. So,
who helped me?
There must have been somebody else writing that stuff, because that's pretty good. I don't know. There are times you get done and it was kind of – you loved it and hated it at the same time, because you spent so much time on it. It was hard to know that is this really good or not. And at the same time you got done, you thought, I could not make this any better than what I think I've come up with. So I don't know, stories in particular, it's hard to pinpoint any. You know, we've done so many different things and gone so many different places, talked to so many really interesting people. One of the highlights might have been going to South Africa with Simon Estes and
the renowned world opera singer from Centerville, Iowa.
Yeah, and I worked with Chuck Offenberger on that story, and I would tell him what I wanted to. I'd sort of structure the show out, and I'd say, I need you to write something to segue between these different elements that I'd call them elements, locations, whatever, that would get us from one part of the story to the next. And it was an incredible trip. South Africa's a beautiful place. We got there right after apartheid. We were shooting Porgy and Bess. It was the first all black production that was ever done in Cape Town, South Africa. So the first evening I shot outside in the auditorium and shot pretty much the entire production. And then the next night I went back behind stage and shot everything from back there.
Oh.
Which was way cool too.
Really?
It was an interesting trip. You kind of got the feeling that it seemed like everybody was getting along pretty well. I just didn't know how long that was going to last, because the euphoria of being done with apartheid, I think there was still that feeling, and I wasn't sure how long it'd be before people feeling like, all right, we're past that. Let's, I'm still economically depressed, right. You know. And there was a lot of different feelings I was having when I was there as well. It's like for people to racially profile somebody, Cape Town was interesting in that the center of Cape Town was pretty much white, and as you got out, it got darker and darker and darker. So the darker you were, the further out from the middle of the city you were. And that bothered me a lot, you know. Is if you were in the city at a certain time, you couldn't be there, let's say, after 6 p.m. You had to be out of the city and back wherever was where you were supposed to be at that time. So it's absolutely gorgeous. At the same time, it was pretty ugly.
Yeah, right. What a weird mode to be thinking about, knowing how beautiful the landscape is. And I would imagine the only thing that we can relate to is, say, when Josh went to Cuba, very beautiful land, but still an economically mixed up. Now, it's not a race thing like it was in South Africa. So
it's really hard to describe because you go to a grade school or whatever, and there's razor wire all the way around it. You go to a mall, there's razor wire around it. We were there in a township where all the houses were just pretty much corrugated huts that were right on top of each other. We were at a mall walking around, and we get done. I'm shooting some stuff over in this overpass over these rail lines. And we get back to this car, back to the car, and Chuck goes, "Did you see the knife?" I go, "What?" I said, "Knife." He said, some guy pulled a knife on him. And throughout the day, we had these guys following us around in this Datsun, I think it was, with a bunch of Aloha shirts on. And we couldn't figure out what the heck was going on. Those guys were actually the mall security to make sure that we didn't get in trouble. You know,
so you didn't have a security detail?
No, not when we were
officially
there.
Officially. No. You had a bunch of guys in a Datsun in Hawaiian shirts.
Just on that particular time, I didn't even know how they knew that we were there. The young man that was showing us around, it stepped in between Chuck and the guy with the knife, and he was Caucasian. He's actually an Iowan, and said something to him in whatever the native tongue was. And his three buddies came by and picked him up and took him off instead of there being any problems at all. But yeah, it was kind of I was a little stupid too, I think. I don't know how long you want to talk about this, but when the first night I got there, I asked, checked into the hotel, and we, I was ready to go out for a walk because I used to go for walks at night. And I started out the door, and I noticed that there were two security guys there, and I turned around, and I thought, maybe I shouldn't be going for a walk. I mean, even here in Des Moines or any place in Iowa, there may not be good places to go for a walk.
Correct.
So I turned around, and I said, is it all right to go for a walk? And they sort of looked at me like, what?
People do that willingly?
People actually go for walks, and they said, no. And I said, well, can I just go walk around the parking lot? And they said, sure. So I think it was pretty close about the time we were leaving. And we'd been there for a while. You could see Cape Town downtown from the hotel. So then I'm going to walk downtown. So one morning I just took off, walked downtown. I think I might have bought a converter for electricity or something, came back. About halfway back, I'm thinking, this may not have been my best idea ever. And so they... Final day, we're there. I'd sort of said to Chuck Offenberger, I said, God, it's driving me nuts. I can taste the salt water on my lips, and I can see the beach, but I haven't been to the beach. And he said, well, you could ask the cab driver to drive you there tomorrow morning. So we went to the opera. On the way back, I asked the guy, will you pick me up and take me to the beach tomorrow morning? And he said, what time? I said, like 6 a.m., because not only after the beach, we were supposed to go visit Bishop Tutu, and then go to the airport. So he said, sure, he'd do that. So I got up, took the camera with me. Didn't see him in the parking lot when I went downstairs, but I had the camera and I shot this gorgeous sunset or sunrise as the sun's coming up over the mountains off in the distance. So I turn around to go back in the hotel, and I pass this car, and I look down, and he's asleep in the car. I think he slept there all night just waiting for me. So I tap on the window. I said, "Are you the driver?" He said, "Sure." And I said, "Let's go." So I hop in the car. We go to the beach. And as we get to this, the mountains come right out of the ocean. We're on the beach, and the sun's coming up over those mountains now. So I shot two sunrises in one day. It was the most incredible thing ever. And we get back in the car after I jump in the ocean, and we're driving back, and he takes me back a different way. And he's saying, "This part of town's not so good." And I said, "Oh, great. This is where I walked the other day." He said, "You're pretty lucky."
Yeah.
And he's our guide who was showing us around most of the time said that most everybody in Cape Town had been mugged. Or it's a given that you will be mugged if you lived in Cape Town, I guess. So I don't know.
Sometimes it's better to not know what's going on around you, or at least acknowledge what's going on.
They must have figured I was the most crazy white person that they never wanted to mess with.
And that could have been too.
It's like, this guy has no idea what he's doing. He must be crazy, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So you probably didn't have any trips like that when you were domestically traveling from market to market, did you?
No. No, I never had to do anything quite like that, where turn around and ask the guard at the gate if it's all right
if
to
it's
go
okay
for a walk.
For a walk, yeah. Well, Fargo is a rough town.
Yeah.
You came – so Chuck Offenberg, I probably need to say, was the Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register for years, and still is in Iowa and still is around and likes to tell stories about Iowans. And
it's so a great guy.
He is a wonderful man. And you then come to Market to Market because the Living in Iowa show comes to an end. You and I both put into a show that we didn't come to – we weren't hired for. We came in too. When you try to tell a story – again, you and I couldn't do 6 minutes. I could probably do 6 minutes on chestnuts, but you were able to do 6 minutes. it was like a Living in Iowa story back for you. But the news side of things wasn't really what drove you. You'd do it if you had to.
No, and it never was. I mean, I did water quality stories. I did things that were interesting to me. I did a story about a guy that was raising crops in an underground cave in Indiana. And the reason he was doing that was because he was trying to genetically modify these crops to grow pharmaceuticals. He was farming with a pH.
And is that what he said, or you came up with
that's
that?
What he had said. My goal was always to tell stories of there's a lot of people out there. And the people that I did stories on were people who were trying to make the world a better place. And I always tell people that I didn't always necessarily agree with what they were doing, but that was their dream. And my goal was to make it so that they could share that vision with other people and see if it worked for them, I guess, you know. And some people, just about everybody I did a story with, it was easy to get the emotion out of them because it was something that they believed in. And it made storytelling pretty easy. You know, my job as a producer was always to get people to open up and tell me what they thought was important, not what I thought was important. And that's what I was always trying to do.
You would work with a photographer, but sometimes you'd have to go out and shoot on your own. I remember during the floods of, I don't know if it was the 08 flood or if it was
floods in 93.
Well, 93, you did a lot then. What was your mission in 93? What were you thinking about when you're out covering stories at that time?
It's kind of a funny story too, because I think my boss at the time said, "Don't go do anything while I'm gone." But I got a hold of Dan Miller after my boss had left, I guess, and said somebody ought to be documenting what's going on in the Mississippi. And he agreed, so I went out for a week and I just drove to Keokuk and worked my way north up along the Mississippi from there. And if something was going on, I'd stop and shoot it, or if I saw something happening. I think one of the first things I saw was a farmer rescuing his hogs on the Des Moines River. It wasn't even on the Mississippi, but they were getting flooded, so I shot some stuff. And he wasn't even sure he wanted me to shoot anything, because for him, his neighbors would see it and think he was a bad farmer for letting things get to this stage. I told him I didn't think that was the case at all, that floodwaters rise fast, you get yourself in a perilous situation, but you're out here trying to make things right, you know. Wasn't like he was going to let his hogs drown or anything. He's
right
out there.
Yeah. Converse,
putting them in a John boat, in a crate, one at a time, to get them to safety.
Conversely, he was actually a good farmer for what he was doing.
Yeah. So that was the first thing. I think one of the last things. So I'd just go along, and if I saw something, I'd shoot it. There was one night, you know, I'd work from sunrise to sunset just about. Came to the hotel one night, and Clinton was on TV. Talking about the floods. So I just shot a little bit of the TV with them on it so I could use it in the story. You know, it was like one of the things that you always do is you got to see an opportunity and seize it, I guess. Another story that worked on was right after the Oklahoma City bombing of the federal building. And they had a tree planting down there. A bunch of Iowans took trees down there, and they were going to build this memorial for the people who died in it, with each tree representing someone who died. And I was there, and I was shooting it, and I wanted to get to the site of the bombing, but hadn't gotten there yet. And I was talking to some of the kids, and they said, "Well, we're going down there. Would you like to come?" And I was like, "Well, heck yes." It hadn't even dawned on me that that was something that should do, but it was an important part of the story, because then you're getting the emotional impact of these kids at the site, seeing it and realizing what they're actually doing. And I came back, and I think I said to my boss, I said, "Yeah, I got pretty lucky." He said, "No, you recognized opportunity, you know. You got to be able to see an opportunity and seize, and that goes through just about everything you do in life, you know. You got to be smart enough to know an opportunity when you see it."
Mm-hmm.
And you got to work hard for what you do too. It would have been easy just to say, "Nah, I'm going to go eat lunch, and then I'm going to go out here." It's like I probably had to skip lunch and work a bunch more that day than I wanted to, but it was always important to get people to tell their story, you know. And there's been a lot of times where worked a 12-hour day, skipped lunch, might have ate a pretzel or two, and then you're back on the road, you know.
It's, oh, you feasted.
Yeah.
With your pretzel.
Yeah.
You did that quite often. I think a lot of times we would call. And so let's go to 93. I want to touch back on that. 93, you're making the rounds without a cell phone. You're making without a GPS. You probably had a map or two in your bag. But you're just kind of following your nose, and you're like, "Well, the river probably bends this way, and I bet I have to go over here." You'd probably been down there already through your other travels. Yeah. So it's not like you knew every road, but you kind of knew that eventually that road is going to go north and it's going to intersect.
Right.
I'll find something. I think in 08 and maybe 10 and 11, I think I did it in 10 and in 08, you did the same thing. You kind of went along some of those same areas, and you were just gone for 3-4 days, and you saw the crops that were eaten away. I ask this usually of people that deal with farmers from around the country. Are farmers in other states different than farmers in another state? So is an Oregon farmer different than an Iowa farmer, which is different than a Vermont or Pennsylvania farmer?
I never noticed a difference. People are pretty much the same everywhere, it seems like. And like I said, I'm looking for people that want to share a story. I could tell you a lot more stories about the Mississippi. There was a woman that I stopped and was talking to. Her trailer court, she ran, had flooded. And I asked her if I could talk to her, and she said she didn't think so. So I turned the camera on and just started asking her questions. I had it on my shoulder, and I'm just sort of looking around. Shoot wide enough, then you can capture anything pretty much. So we got done with me talking to her, and she goes, "Did you roll on that?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "But I won't use it unless you say it's okay." And she said she thought it'd be okay. And people would be nervous when you come in with a camera sometimes, and I'd always – once again, my job was to make them as comfortable as possible. And I'd always, they'd want to know all the questions I was going to ask.
Right.
And I said, no, I don't do that either. I said, but it's a conversation. We're having a conversation. I can guarantee you there's not a question that I'm going to ask you you don't know. Because I'm always trying to pull the emotion out of somebody. And I said, if there's something you don't know, we'll stop the camera, we'll look it up. But most of those facts and figures I can get on my own. I don't even need you
to
tell me.
I'm not here for facts and figures.
No, not at all. That's not what I was there for. I was trying to get their story. We were up in Oregon. I did a story on the irrigation issues with salmon up there. And when I was up there, one of the guys asked me if I'd heard about this wetland rotation program that they had up there. I said, no. And right away I'm thinking, that's even more of a fun story than I think I'm working on now. So I told him, I said, I'll be back. About a year later, Mark to Market sent me up there again, and we did that story. And it was a great story. I think they were using it in schools and things like that just to,
wow,
to show what it was for, you know. You just sort of have to say, wow. So people would tell you things, and you'd just jump on them, you know. It was like there was no shortage of ideas and stories out there.
But again, it goes back to what you just said just a couple minutes ago. You still have to be listening, and yeah, you still got to be seizing that opportunity that presents itself. I was just having this conversation with our seventh graders at confirmation last night, and they're like, how do I know where God's presenting signs to me? I go, it's not going to be a giant billboard. But it's going to be somewhere where you're like, it's going to make total sense for you to go left as opposed to right. And it's just going to be clear to you. And that's probably what's happening. And that's probably what happened to you more times than not. It's just like, really? That's all you got to say to someone.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, and you also have to shut up and let people talk, you know? And maybe that's part of it, too. There was times where somebody get done with something, and I just sort of look at them. And I'll tell you, 90% of the time, they'll come up with the quote that you want at that moment because they figure they have to fill something in. And all of a sudden, they're speaking more from their heart than they are from anywhere else. And I used to love to do that, just sort of nod and look at them and mm-hmm. wait for them to say the next thing.
You got that look about you, too. It just looks like you don't know what you're going to talk about next. Maybe it looks confused. It's that gift that you were given, Chris. All right, final story, and I don't want you to use the name of the person that you were with on this, but I want folks to know you're an excellent storyteller, as people are finding out when they're listening to this. I want you to tell the story when you work with someone else, and sometimes the other person you're working with, it might be a little more friction, and you're just at the end of the day, you're like, where are we going to eat? It's like, you know, your work spouse, and you came with this one person. And you're like, well, where do you want to eat tonight? And you pointed to a restaurant. You know what story I'm talking about?
I think I do, but I don't know I'm never going to tell this story.
You'd been somewhere. Let's just say you're in Kansas. And your coworker says, well, where do you want to eat tonight? And I say, I don't know. And the person you're with says, well, how about that restaurant? And you say, well, if you eat there, you eat alone.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I actually liked shooting my own stuff a lot, too, is because you didn't have to worry about somebody not getting lunch. Guys in the FP are great, you know, and that's where I came from. And they're out shooting all the time. And I go out and shoot with them, and I wouldn't know what their day was like the day before. Mm-hmm. And they may have had a 12-hour day. They may have had something pretty easy. But for me, it was like if I went out by myself, I didn't have to worry whether or not they had a rough day the day before. Whether somebody had not given them lunch the day before, mm-hmm. or if they don't want to work a 12-hour day. So that's why I went out and mm-hmm. shoot a lot of my own stuff.
Yeah.
Worked with incredible people. And I'd be remiss not to mention a very good – I had some great friends here. Still do. They're friends for life. And I tell people that I retired from the best job ever. It was absolutely – it was hard to believe that somebody would retire from a job like this, but sometimes you figure it's time, and there's plenty of life left to live. It still drives my kids nuts that I'll stop and talk to anybody, but I think maybe they've grown old enough now that it doesn't bother them quite as much.
But come on, Dad, let's go.
It's like I'm sitting on a stump somewhere and somebody's sitting next to me and striking up a conversation. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was the job or just what, but.
You were fantastic. And so you had no idea what we were going to talk about.
No.
And that's why I appreciate you giving me time. Coming in off your retirement, go back to eating your Cheetos and watching Jeopardy's on here now. You got to go. So these retired guys.
I had a snort. There you go.
Chris Gourley, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Please send us any audio comments you have about the program to markettomarket@iptv.org. I'm Paul Yeager. Thanks for listening.